An outpouring of love and support has surrounded the nation's LGBTQ community since the tragic massacre at a gay nightclub in Orlando, and activists have received renewed attention to the fight for sexual orientation equality. One of the biggest issues in that fight today has been over bathrooms. The federal government established nationwide guidelines for school bathrooms last month. Its policy states schools that restrict transgender students from using the bathroom of their choice could be cut off from federal funds. That federal directive rubbed many people in Georgia the wrong way. Georgia is part of an 11-state lawsuit against the Obama administration for overreaching its constitutional power. The balance between state and federal power has always been pretty hotly contested, and we wanted to ask the question, what is the current state of states' rights, and how much has it changed over the years? For that, we have Eric Siegel. He's a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Hello again, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Scott Gaylord. He's law professor at Elon University. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
So before we talk about our modern view of states' rights, let's kind of take it back to the founders. This is a clip from a video produced by the Washington Post. They argue that James Madison, one of the founders, was hesitant to give the states too much power.
Madison had a whole critique of the way in which state governments, more than the national government, were likely to pass laws that would be unfair to minorities, maybe religious minorities, maybe racial minorities, maybe the minorities holding large amounts of property. So Madison felt that the smaller the entity, the easier it was to pass unjust legislation.
Eric, you're nodding your head. You'd agree with that characterization?
I think James Madison definitely thought that. He was concerned about factions, local and national. I'll let Scott take this one because he's going to be more sympathetic to 18th
to the argument of the founders.
Well, to 18th century beliefs than I am. Yes.
Oh, come on now. And so it begins. Scott,
hold on.
Scott, is limiting state power to a certain extent part of our constitutional history?
I think it certainly is part of the history. I mean, you can go back prior to the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. I mean, sort of the founders' first attempt to get things to work out. And in the wake of, you know, life under the British monarchy, there was a great concern, and the founders were very wary of centralizing power. And as a result, under the Articles, the central government was incredibly weak, and it just didn't work. I mean, it came to the realization that we had to get together. And so the Constitutional Convention back in May of 1787 was really about trying to, at first, amend the Articles of Confederation because they weren't working. But within 5 days, they realized that we need to scrap that altogether and work on the Constitution. And then the disagreements between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists and trying to figure out what the proper balance of power would be came to the forefront. And Madison certainly thought it was important to have both federal and state government concerned about that balance of power, but really thinking that you'd have the two governments, they would help control each other, that they would have their own spheres of operation, Federalist 51, Federalist 46, and you pit ambition
right
against ambition.
We can't talk about state power versus the federal government without realizing, as the Supreme Court unanimously said, unanimously, in a case called Mitchum versus Foster, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution were passed specifically to alter the balance of power between the state and federal governments and to put federal judges, federal officials, and the national government in between the states and the people to the extent the states were violating the people's rights. That is just as important to today's world, more important to today's world than anything that happened in the 18th century.
So the 13th, for those of you who do not have the Constitution memorized, the 13th Amendment was the one that abolished slavery.
Yeah.
The 14th was definition
equal
of citizenship.
And due process. And,
right. Okay. And then the 15th was the right to vote.
Yes.
Protecting the right to
right
vote. Okay.
But a unanimous Supreme Court said
right
the purpose of that was to alter the balance of power between the state and federal governments.
For oversight purposes.
For all purposes.
Okay, so then let's fast forward a lot to the era of Reagan, former President Reagan. Here he is talking about the relationship of states between state and federal governments when it comes to taxes.
It doesn't make sense to me for the federal government to take that money first and insist that the only solution to our local problems is for them to take the money. And then they dispense it back to you in grants in which they tell you how to spend it from Washington, D.C. And of course, like an agent with a Hollywood actor, there's a certain carrying charge that's deducted in Washington before you get it back again.
Well, that's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
Why is that ridiculous?
Well, we can pass a new constitutional amendment if we want to stop the federal government from collecting income tax, but we do have that amendment so they can do that. And after they do that, when they say to the states, as they've done in the LGBT controversy, if you want our money, you have to do X, Y, and Z. But if you don't want our money, You don't have to do X, Y, and Z. And there is nothing unconstitutional about that.
So this means that you feel as though this law, I'm going to get you, Scott, don't worry.
Sure,
but
no
this,
problem.
This dictate from the federal government saying if you want federal funds for your public school, then you have to allow open access to bathrooms for transgender. You feel that's perfectly constitutional, Eric?
Sure. If the states don't want to do that, don't take the money.
Scott, would you agree?
Well, certainly there's a broad power for the federal government with respect to taxing and spending. There's no doubt about that. But the court has expressly said that it's not unlimited. And we see that in NFIB versus Sebelius with respect to the spending powers with Medicaid. And the court imposed limits on the federal government and actually said that you went too far. If you can sort of incentivize states to act or adopt federal policy, but you can't coerce or compel them to do that. And so it depends, as the court has set out in a couple of different cases, it's going to now see seems to depend on the amount of pressure
excuse
that's
me, not
put
a couple
on the
cases.
Court.
Not a couple cases. Let
Scott finish,
well,
and then we'll get to Eric.
Certainly, South Dakota versus Dole sort of sets that out as well in terms of 0.5% of a state's budget does not constitute coercion. But if you get up to
you're losing me just a little bit, Scott, because I don't know these cases. All you're saying,
sure.
Can I boil it down and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong?
That'd be fine.
It sounds like what you're saying is, yes, the federal government has the power to do with their money they've collected as they will. And yes, they can limit what the states can do before they remove federal government. But as soon as that becomes coercion, then it becomes unconstitutional? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. The choice for the state must be knowing and voluntary. And
right.
So the conditions have to be spelled out clearly, but then the voluntariness comes in. And the court in NFIB versus Sebelius, which is the most recent case that Eric is talking about, just set this condition out there.
Right.
We're trying to see where that limit is.
Before we take a break, Eric, you wanted to respond.
Two quick points. NFIB versus Sebelius was the first case since the New Deal to ever strike down a law under the spending power.
True.
And two, it's incredibly incorrectly decided.
You disagree with the Supreme Court.
Well, of course, because I'm not allowed to say to you your wallet or your life. That's an unconstitutional choice. If I see you in the alley and I say your wallet or your life,
that's robbery.
I have no right to impose either condition. The federal government has no obligation to give the states any money. When they do so, they can say, take it. Don't take it. I'm not going to kill you if you don't take it. You just lose the money. And that's how the law was until the obviously nakedly political decision in NFIB
versus
Sebelius.
So we have this lawsuit which is going forward, and Georgia is a party to that, saying that the federal government can't withhold funds for public schools because of access to bathrooms on the part of transgender kids. But there's another issue that I want to bring up that has especially become important lately, and that is gun control. And this is another place, Scott, in which there's arguments over what states can do and what the federal government can do. One of our own listeners, as we were talking about, there's a petition now to ban assault weapons, said, well, why don't we just let the states decide whether to allow assault weapons or not? What do we know about the limits of federal power on that issue?
To me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think this is certainly trying to figure out in the wake of the Supreme Court's decisions recognizing the Second Amendment right. I think the Ninth Circuit just came out with an important decision saying there was no right to concealed carry, that you had to make a specific showing of need for that. So that's a really important decision in terms of, limitations on what the states can do.
Well, because states disagree on that. Some have more lax rules in terms of who can conceal carry. Is that why you mentioned that?
Correct. That you'd see, to the extent, and a lot of these issues, to the extent they're left to the states, obviously, then it gives you that idea of Justice Brandeis, states as laboratories for experiment to try different things and do different things. When the federal government comes in and sets the policy, obviously, that's going to nationalize it for everybody. And the federal government has broad authority under its taxing, spending, and commerce power to regulate lots of things. What we're seeing is seeing situations in which states are stepping in and trying to say, well, we want to have control or not. And it's ultimately left to the courts as the last arbiters of all things constitutional to determine what that is. And given the current makeup of the court with, Justice Scalia's passing and the open vacancy, I think these issues can become all more important, not only on the specific issues as to gun control, bathroom access, or anything else, but this larger federalism issue between state and federal authority.
I think the states should be free to regulate guns as they see fit without any constraint from the Second Amendment, which was completely misread by the Supreme Court in Heller for the first time in American history to allow for a constitutional right to own guns. Now, having said that, I don't think Congress is going to get in this game very much for obvious reasons, including
the lobbying, gun control
game. So it's even more important that states be allowed, the states that want to, should be allowed to enact pretty much whatever gun reform laws they want to. One more thing about this. If there's ever an issue for states' rights people, it should be guns, because what is needed in Montana and Savannah and New York City and Brooklyn and Chicago are all very different things. And we shouldn't have national rules about this, and we never did.
And yet, Eric, oftentimes the argument for federal oversight, in this case we're talking about the Supreme Court, is that you'll have all these different laws and you'll pass over a state border, and what you can carry in your car changes, and what, you know, the way, what you can have in your cell phone contract changes. So often the argument for federal oversight is that state laws are all over the map.
That's a great point. But that's when we need uniformity for economic sake, or for future planning's sake. And it's always a balance anyway. If Chicago thinks, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, if Chicago thinks the city is going to have less murders with less guns, whereas Fayetteville thinks it's going to have less murders with more guns, either community should be allowed to make that decision free of any constitutional constraint, because the Second Amendment had nothing to do with this. The Second Amendment was well-regulated militia, and from 1781 until 2008, virtually every court in the United States said that. So all I'm suggesting is, if there is ever an issue that should be decided locally, it is the relationship between guns and safety.
So, Scott, how does this, let's bring this back to this lawsuit that to which Georgia is a party in terms of access to bathrooms by transgender students. Does federal oversight possibly step in here in terms of, A, the fact that the federal government has the constitutional power to control its own funds, and B, that some oversight by the federal government is needed in some cases to protect minorities?
I mean, certainly that's the central issue here. And in terms of the federal government's ability to do that, they need to do that within constitutional parameters as well. So the federal government's power is not unlimited. And to the extent one disagrees with NFIB versus Sebelius, that's fine. But it is the governing Supreme Court precedent. And that precedent says that there are limits on the federal government's spending power. Title IX is supported through the Congress's spending power. And so if they're going to exert that and threaten to withhold all Title IX money, which, you know, the Human Rights Campaign suggests it's about $4.5 billion in Title IX funds for North Carolina. Texas has said it's more than $10 billion.
I want to make sure everyone is still with you. Title IX is the clause that says no American should be excluded from participation in educational activities because of their sex or the basis of
by entities receiving federal funds.
Right.
Funds.
It's not a general
connected directly
rule.
To the
right.
It's the spending power. Correct.
Right.
It's supported by the fact that, as Eric mentioned, the federal government's giving you this money. If you want that money, then the claim is you do what we want you to do, and if not, we'll take our money and go home.
I want to be clear. I never said there were no limits on the spending power. What I said is the limit, for instance, the condition has to be clear. Scott and I agree on that. The condition
correct.
Has to be clear. What I disagree with is that there's the coercion element that NFIB added for the first time in American history as a holding, not as a dictum, but as a holding. That element of it doesn't make any coherent sense. Take the money, don't take the money. If it's up to you, then it's not coercive. And it is up to North Carolina. They can, or Georgia, they can refuse this money. They are allowed to refuse this money.
We could, but then that's a huge amount of the budget. We've only got a couple minutes left. You wanted to say something else, Scott?
Oh, just to say, I mean, it's true. There's sort of the choice at some level, but what the court has said is that it's a gun to the head of state. So just like the Medicaid funding was, when you're removing all of that, it's such a high amount that it's really not freedom of choice, and it's a conscripting the states into what the court talked about as the national bureaucratic army. And at least under NFIB, that's not permitted.
Just to be devil's advocate here, not that Eric isn't enough of one, but in the last minute that we have, that's because Georgia has chosen to rely on federal funds, right? I mean, Georgia could give more money to the public schools.
But again,
schools.
This condition wasn't there. And another concern in NFIB is whether or not you can change the conditions ex post. And, you know, Title IX was set out in 1972. It's not clear. This interpretation is relatively recent. Is that a change? That'll be another issue that the courts have to address.
But that changes
in
all
the current decisions.
States, and this is in the Medicaid case, actually, the states were told it's going to change. That's even another reason that case was so frivolous. But states know that vague terms in statutes as interpreted by executive agencies, the meaning is going to change over time. And they agree to be bound by the legal changes that happen in that sense.
Okay. Obviously, the discussion over what state rights means continues in the United States. Eric Siegel is a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Scott Gaylord is a law professor at Elon University. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for having us on the program.
Thanks.
Thank you, Eric. Have a great day,
you
everybody.
Too.